Many of you know that this last summer I went to Israel, and it was almost an indescribable experience how amazing that was. Out of that, I got asked to go for football, actually. They have the Israeli Football League. They play American football over there. I got asked to go coach. Me and some other high school coaches and college coaches went over there, and we worked with a team one night called the Jerusalem Lions, and we also worked with their national team, which ended up beating Spain and got them qualified into the European Football League, which they're getting ready to start that little tournament. So that's how I ended up over there. And, of course, got to do some sightseeing and going around Israel and the country and stuff. There were two distinct times when I was around there that I really felt, I couldn't say it was an audible voice, but I really felt like, you need to share this, you need to share this. And one was about the miracles of Peter, which I talked about a few months ago, and the other one was what I wanted to talk about today. And I came back really excited and had breakfast with Sean and said, look, I've got to talk about this, and it's about this whole Passion Week, and no pastor in America is going to let somebody else speak on Easter, so I get the week before. So here I am. I'm going to talk about the Passion Week and things that were going on and kind of understand some of the Jewish heritage and culture and just things that kind of explain what was going on a little more in depth and take the story that really for years reading felt like I missed stuff that I didn't realize I was missing until I was over there and learned about it. And so hopefully I can share that with you today and you guys can be as excited as I was about it. So I start out with asking, what about the water? And it's about the depths of the events and just kind of understand their culture and the expectations that they had about the Messiah. And we'll start here in 1 Corinthians 10, 1 through 4. I've got most of the verses up, not all of them, but I'm going to jump around a lot today too. It says, "For I do not want you to be ignorant of the fact, brothers, that our forefathers were all under the cloud, and that they all passed through the sea. They were all baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. They all ate the same spiritual food and drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank from the spiritual rock that accompanied them, and that rock was Christ." A lot of scholars believe, Scott talked about it, I think it was Scott, talked about it a couple weeks ago where Moses struck the rock. Was you talked about it? All right, thought it was Scott. Either way, Sean talked about it. He struck the rock instead of speaking to it, but the water flowed, and many scholars believe that they actually, because of this, carried that rock with them through the desert. So they didn't just leave it. They always had that water because they physically carried that rock around with them. And that rock represented Christ and the future coming Messiah, who also provided our living water. And so that's everything that they do, that the Jewish culture does, is really meant to either remind them of their past or tell them about the future and what's coming. So I'm going to go through this week. I'm going to start with the night of Jesus' betrayal in Luke in chapter 22. When the hour came, Jesus and his apostles reclined at the table, and he said to them, "I have eagerly desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer. For I tell you, I will not eat it again until it finds fulfillment in the kingdom of God." The Passover had a lot of meaning that, like I said, I just learned about when I was over there. There's more to it than just the passing over. That's, of course, the initial part. But the meal was meant to evoke memories. It wasn't a celebration. It wanted you to recall the 10th and final plague from their freedom, from their slavery and bondage in Egypt. So, but it wasn't just a memory. They wanted you to feel it and really remember. So it was a big process that went into this Passover meal. And so the meal had four cups of wine that went along with the food. And the four cups of wine were based on the four I will promises in Exodus. So if you want to flip back to Exodus in chapter 6, or you can just look on the screen. But in Exodus chapter 6, he said, "Therefore I say to the Israelites, I am the Lord, and I will bring you out from under the yoke of the Egyptians. I will free you from being slaves to them, and I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with mighty acts of judgment. I will take you as my own people, and I will be your God. Then you will know that I am the Lord your God who brought you out from under the yoke of the Egyptians. So there in there is those four I will promises that the four cups of wine are based on. And so when they would gather together for the meal, they would drink their first cup of wine. And the first cup of wine was called the cup of sanctification. And this was based on God's statement, I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. And then, for those of you that flipped to Exodus, if you want to turn to chapter 12. After they drank that cup of wine, they would recite Exodus 12, verse 12, together as a group. And it is, on that same night, I will pass through Egypt and strike down every firstborn, both men and animals, and I will bring judgment on all the gods of Egypt. I am the Lord. Now, there's a problem with that, because it says, I will strike down every firstborn. So everyone was included, including the Jews. Everyone was included in this death sentence. So they needed to find a way out of that, obviously, and God provided. In order to survive the plague, they had to take out a year-old lamb, had to be without flaw or defect. They had to find it on the 10th day of the month and keep it in their home until the 14th day. And that was when the lamb was to be slaughtered. Now, as I talk about this, I also want you to think about what's going on this week in our Passion Week, because that's 4 days that the lamb was in the home, just like Jesus was there at the temple that week preaching after the Palm Sunday. That second cup, the cup of judgment or deliverance. Now, this was based on God's statement, I will save you. And they would have the second cup of wine, and the leader at the meal would recite this, let us fill our cups a second time. A full cup is a symbol of joy, and we are indeed filled with joy at God's almighty deliverance. But let us also remember the great cost at which redemption was purchased. Lives were sacrificed to bring about the release of God's people from the slavery of Egypt. This was then followed by the actual meal. So they had the two glasses of wine, or cups of wine, and then they had the meal. Passover meal, the broken bread, was a reminder of the Passover lamb. Without the sacrificial death of the lamb, there was not going to be a rescue. Jesus, as we know, redefined what the bread meant and said that was his body. After supper, they had the third cup of wine. This is the cup of redemption. It's the I will redeem you promise. It was based on, I will redeem you with an outstretched arm. Redemption is to purchase back something, okay, that had been lost, or the payment of a ransom. The cup symbolized the blood of the Passover lamb. So each family now had to apply this blood over their doorposts. It was the visible sign of their faith in the Lord, which was then in Exodus 12 there, verse 13. The blood will be a sign for you on the houses where you are. And when I see the blood, I will pass over you. No destructive plague will touch you when I strike Egypt. The words Passover don't simply mean to step over, like I don't want to touch it. It's also like spreading wings over, like in order to protect, as if God was putting his arms around their house, guarding their door. He was protecting them. And that's what the third cup of wine represented, was God protecting their family. So Jesus, obviously, as we know, redefined the cup. This is a new covenant in my blood, which is shed for you. The fourth cup, which he didn't drink, is the cup of praise or restoration. This was based on God's statement, I will take you to be my people, and I will be your God. Then they would sing a hymn, and then the dinner was over. For Jesus, what that meant was they went to the Mount of Olives. So we're going to get into the mind of Jesus here a little bit. And what's going on? Oh, there's 12:13. All right. So back in Luke 35, chapter 22, 35 to 37. Then Jesus asked them, when I sent you without purse, bag, or sandals, did you lack anything? Nothing, they answered. And he said to them, but now if you have a purse, take it, and also a bag. And if you don't have a sword, sell your cloak and buy one. It is written, and he was numbered with the transgressors. And I tell you that this must be fulfilled in me. Yes, what is written about me is reaching its fulfillment. The part in red there is where Jesus was quoting the Tanakh, which is fun to say and weird to spell. But it's the way the rabbis taught a lot of times, Not everybody had a copy of the Bible like we do now. They didn't have a copy of the Tanakh, which is their version of it with the Old Testament readings. And so the way the rabbis would teach to save a lot of time was they would quote part of it in order for you to understand the context of what they were talking. For example, if I was going to do something like that today, I might say, "For God so loved the world." So you know what I'm talking about without having to say the whole thing. So that's kind of the way the rabbis of the time, and Jesus was a rabbi, would teach a lot. They would just quote parts. And in right here, he was quoting from Isaiah in chapter 53. Verse 12. "Therefore I will give him a portion among the great, and he will divide the spoils with the strong, because he poured out his life unto death, and was numbered with the transgressors. For he bore the sin of many, and made many and made intercession for the transgressors. Which the interesting thing is that since this happened, the rabbis, the ancient rabbis from back then, they stopped reading Isaiah 53. And you can go back and read the whole thing later, but they stopped reading this in their synagogues. So a lot of Jews today have never even heard of this chapter because they don't read it anymore. And you can read in that. I'm not getting into that because I don't have time. So. All right. So he was quoting that to teach. So moving on through the night. They're out. They're praying. And what the disciples keep doing? They were falling asleep. Okay. He rose from prayer, went back to the disciples. He found them asleep. Why were they asleep? One reason, exhausted from sorrow. At this point, they're starting to understand what's about to happen. He's been explaining. He's been teaching. They get what's going on. But also, they just had this huge, gigantic meal and 4 cups of wine. So this meal, the other thing about it, I mean, I don't know how you guys feel after Thanksgiving dinner, but I'm ready for a nap. Okay, this meal started after several days of just traveling to Jerusalem. So they'd already been traveling just to get there. They had to prepare it. If you'll recall, he said, go prepare a place, and get, you know, they had to get it ready. Prepare the meal, which was big. The meal didn't start until sunset, and it lasted until midnight. I have a hard enough time staying up till midnight anyway, much less after a meal and 4 cups of wine. In fact, being tired was so common at this time that the rabbis had a rule that it was okay to doze off. If you were to doze off at the Passover meal, they could tap you and wake you back up, and that was fine. If you fell sound asleep, then you had to go. So if you notice, though, every time that Jesus went back to them, they always woke right back up. They weren't really out. They were just dozing. But it wasn't uncommon. So it's not an uncommon practice, which, like I said, until I started learning about this, I didn't even realize. So yes, there was some sorrow, but also it was late. And they were tired. A lot was going on. So, what happened after midnight? That's when they came to arrest him. Why? Well, we saw part of it right here with the palm trees. Jesus was very, very popular. Obviously, when the people came in, when he came into the city and shouting, "Hosanna, Hosanna," they couldn't arrest him in broad daylight. There'd have been a riot. They didn't want that. They needed to avoid the uprising. So they needed to arrest him in secret. In Luke 22:6, Judas consented and watched for an opportunity to hand Jesus over to them when no crowd was present. And the disciples weren't the only ones that had this huge Passover meal. The entire Jewish people had this huge Passover meal and their 4 cups of wine, and it's after midnight. And there's nobody out there. There's no crowd present. Judas knew where he was going to be. Luke 21:37-38, each day Jesus was teaching at the temple. Each day. They knew where he was. Each evening he went out to spend the night on the hill called the Mount of Olives, and all the people came early in the morning to hear him at the temple. Luke 22:39, Jesus went out, as usual, to the Mount of Olives. His disciples followed him. It really wasn't a big secret where he was. He'd been doing it all week, which, if you get into the text later, again, trying to save time, but he even said, why are you arresting me now, basically? I've been here all week. What are you waiting for? So Judas led them to Jesus while he was outside of the city, and it was after midnight. Just wanted to show you a couple pictures. That's an olive tree from the Mount of Olives. This one's been dated about 2,000 years old. They don't die. So this one was quite possibly, you know, could have been one they were leaning up against or whatever. There were several, but this is a view from a little higher up on the Mount of Olives. You can see the Dome of the Rock is where the temple was. So the temple would have been sitting right here. Where I took that picture, the olive tree was down over here. This has been built up into a cemetery now. But this was their view at night. They were just walking into the temple here. The southern gate where Jesus preached from was here a lot. Because they would go, this is where they would go in at and just walk down this little valley and up the hill. And it's maybe a 5-10 minute walk. It wasn't very far to just get up this hill. All right. So they came and arrested him. It's after midnight. They took him to Caiaphas's house, the high priest, handed him over to the temple police, and he was, that's where the beating started, and he was thrown in a pit. A couple interesting things about this pit, because we got to go and climb down into it and stand in it. Psalm 88 talks about this pit. And if you want an emotional connection to a verse in the Bible, go stand where it was happening. Here's Psalm 88. O Lord, the God who saves me, day and night I cry out before you. May my prayer come before you. Turn your ear to my cry, for my soul is full of trouble, and my life draws near the grave. I am counted among those who go down to the pit. I am like a man without strength. I am set apart with the dead, like the slain who lie in the grave, whom you remember no more, who are cut off from your care. You have put me in the lowest pit, in the darkest depths. Your wrath lies heavily upon me. You have overwhelmed me with all your waves. You have taken me from my closest friends and have made me repulsive to them. I am confined and cannot escape. My eyes are dim with grief. I call to you, O Lord, every day. I spread out my hands to you. Do you show your wonders to the dead? Do those who are dead rise up and praise you? Is your love declared in the grave, your faithfulness and destruction? Are your wonders known in the place of darkness, or your righteous deeds in the land of oblivion? But I cry to you for help, O Lord. In the morning my prayer comes before you. Why, O Lord, do you reject me and hide your face from me? From my youth I have been afflicted and close to death, have suffered your terrors and am in despair. Your wrath has swept over me. Your terrors have destroyed me. All day long they surround me like a flood. They have completely engulfed me. You have taken my companions and loved ones from me. The darkness is my closest friend. Interesting thing about this pit that he was in, it was a former mikveh. A mikveh is a ritual bath. It's where Jews would cleanse themselves. It was a way of baptizing. And the stairways into these things would have a divide down the middle. You would go down one side dirty, cleanse yourself, come up the other side clean. And we're in the house of the high priest, and it had been drained and was using as a prison. So a little hypocrisy going on there. So all this was going on at night. That was pretty much all they could do, was try and find out what they wanted to do. They finally decided that he was guilty of blasphemy, but they couldn't really do anything yet because it was against the law for the Sanhedrin to convene at night. That had to be during the day, and it had to be in the hall of hewn stone at the temple. So Jesus had to be transported from Caiaphas' house to the temple. I think that picture's next. Yes. All right, so this was Caiaphas' house from the Mount of Olives, right there. The temple's over here to the right. There. This was from a little further down by that cemetery, but Caiaphas' house is right there. So you can see it's just a short walk to where the temple was at. So they needed to get him there, and they wanted to get him there early. We know it was early in the morning because this is when Peter was doing his denials, and he had the third one when the rooster crowed. So at daybreak now, they're in the process of moving Jesus, and they're trying to get him there to the temple. At daybreak, the council of the elders of the people, both the chief priests and the teachers of the law, met together, and Jesus was led before them. Mark 15:1, very early in the morning, chief priests with the elders, the teachers of the law, and the whole Sanhedrin reached a decision. That was when they said he was guilty of blasphemy, and led him away and handed him over to Pilate. So they go to Pilate because they're not allowed to execute. The Jews don't have the power to do that. It has to be the Roman government. So they go to Pilate saying, hey, let's get this done. It's early in the morning. But Pilate really doesn't care about blasphemy. That doesn't really mean anything to him. So they go and they change the charge. Luke 23, verse 1 and 2. Turn to it real quick. Then the whole assembly rose and led him off to Pilate, and they began to accuse him, saying, "We have found this man subverting our nation. He opposes payment of taxes to Caesar and claims to be Christ, a king." Real quick, just because I forgot this picture, but this is the view from Caiaphas's house. There's the Dome of the Rock where the temple was. Here's the Mount of Olives up here. That olive tree was down here. This is that cemetery area. So, again, it's just a short walk. You can see the street right there now. So they changed this charge to political, and Pilate said, I don't see anything wrong with this guy. And then he found out that he was from Galilee. Well, Galilee was under the jurisdiction of Herod Antipas, and so he was in Jerusalem, so he sent him to Herod. This was a big deal because this was messing with the chief priest's timeline. They're wanting to get this execution done and over with. Why? Because Jesus was on a schedule. He'd been on the same schedule every week. The temple opened, and he began preaching at 9 a.m. The rooster just crowed. They just took him to Pilate. They're wanting to get it done before the people start to show up. The soldiers led Jesus away into the palace, that is the praetorium, and called together the whole company of soldiers. They put a purple robe on him, twisted together a crown of thorns, and set it on him. They began to call out to him, "Hail, King of the Jews!" Again and again, they struck him in the head with a staff and spit on him. Falling on their knees, they paid homage to him. And when they had mocked him, they took off the purple robe and put his own clothes on him, and they led him out to crucify him. Pilate had tried three times not to crucify him. I don't see anything wrong with this guy. And the crowd started chanting, "Crucify him, crucify him. We want Barabbas," so on and so forth. But who's doing that? For a long time, people said, oh man. And to me, this is one of those things that leads to the anti-Semitism, because people don't understand who was there and what was going on. And it's a misunderstanding, I think, that hopefully we can learn about today. But it's the crack of dawn on a major Jewish holiday, the morning after everybody had this huge meal and four cups of wine. His supporters weren't there. The people shouting "crucify him" were the corrupt priests, Romans that were there, civilians. That's it. His followers were in bed. They weren't expecting to come until 9. This is why the chief priests were in a hurry. This is why all this stuff was rushed. They were trying to get it done before the supporters came because they didn't want that riot. So when we see this is where the praetorium was, it's been built up over the centuries. This is where Pilate would have been standing up in here. The arch, as you can see, isn't finished because the building's been built out. But the place, where Jesus was beaten and stuff, is back behind these walls. There's more of the road over here, and it's inside a building now. But the floor is still there where they had scratched in the games on the floor. So all that's right there. So obviously it was a little more finished back in the time, but that's where that was happening. So they're not changing their mind about him. Okay, if you look right here in Luke 23, they led him away, seized Simon from Cyrene, who was on his way in from the country, put the cross on him and made him carry it behind Jesus. A large number of people followed him, including women who mourned and wailed for him. How do you, if you don't understand what was going on and you miss the timeline, you go, wait a minute, they were just chanting to crucify him, and now they're crying. They didn't change their mind. They were different people. So they were getting it done. That delay from Herod messed him up. They were getting it done before all those people showed up. The sending him back to Herod and back and forth allowed them, the supporters, to get there for the end. They were just learning of the previous night's events, and that's why they were mourning, because they didn't even realize what was going on. Now, here's the stuff I really start to like about this during the crucifixion. Luke 23, 28 to 31. Jesus turned and said to them, "Daughters of Jerusalem, do not weep for me. Weep for yourselves and for your children. For the time will come when you will say, 'Blessed are the barren women, the wombs that have never bore, and the breasts that have never nursed.' Then they will say to the mountains, 'Fall on us,' and to the hills, 'Cover us.' For if men do these things when the tree is green, what will happen when it was dry?" Jesus has been beaten, and he's carrying his cross down the street, and he's still teaching. That part that I underlined there is from Hosea chapter 10. And I have to share these because they're really good. Israel was a spreading vine. He brought forth fruit to himself. As his fruit increased, he built more altars. As his land prospered, he adorned his sacred stones. Their heart is deceitful, and now they must bear their guilt. The Lord will demolish their altars and destroy their sacred stones. Then they will say, "We have no king because we did not revere the Lord. But even if we had a king, what could he do for us? They make many promises, take false oaths, and make agreements. Therefore, lawsuits spring up like poisonous weeds in a plowed field. The people who live in Samaria fear for the calf idol of Beth-Aven. Its people will mourn over it, and so will its idolatrous priests, those who had rejoiced over its splendor, because it is taken from them into exile. It will be carried to Assyria as tribute for the great king. Ephraim will be disgraced. Israel will be ashamed of its wooden idols. Samaria and its kings will float away like a twig on the surface of the waters. The high places of wickedness will be destroyed. It is the sin of Israel. Thorns and thistles will grow up and cover their altars. Then they will say to us, say to the mountains, 'Cover us,' and to the hills, 'Fall on us.' Since the days of Gibeah you have sinned, O Israel, and there you have remained. Did not war overtake the evildoers in Gibeah? When I please, I will punish them. Nations will be gathered against them to put them in bonds for their double sin. Ephraim is a trained heifer that loves to thresh, so I will put a yoke on her fair neck. I will drive Ephraim, Judah must plow, and Jacob must break up the ground. Sow for yourselves righteousness, reap the fruit of unfailing love, and break up your unplowed ground, for it is time to seek the Lord until he comes and showers righteousness on you. But you have planted wickedness, you have reaped evil, you have eaten the fruit of deception, because you have depended on your own strength and on your many warriors. The roar of battle will rise against your people, so that all your fortresses will be devastated. As Shalman devastated Beth Arbel on the day of battle, when mothers were dashed to the ground with her children, thus will it happen to you, O Bethel, because your wickedness is great. When that day dawns, the king of Israel will be completely destroyed." To me, this, I think he's talking about the destruction of the temple that's coming. Just about 70 years away or so is the way I took what he was talking about there. All right, so third hour, he's crucified. It's about 9 o'clock in the morning. Then in the sixth hour, darkness came over the whole land until the ninth hour. And in that day, declares the sovereign Lord, "I will make the sun go down at noon and darken the earth in broad daylight." Jesus called out with a loud voice, "Father, into your hands I commit my spirit." His last words, he's still teaching. Look at Psalm 31. "In you, O Lord, I have taken refuge. Let me never be put to shame. Deliver me in your righteousness. Turn your ear to me. Come quickly to my rescue. Be my rock of refuge, a strong fortress to save me. You are my rock and my fortress. For the sake of your name, lead and guide me. Free me from the trap that is set for me, for you are my refuge. Into your hands I commit my spirit. Redeem me, O Lord, the God of truth. I hate those who cling to worthless idols. I trust in the Lord. I will be glad and rejoice in your love, for you saw my affliction and knew the anguish of my soul. You have not handed me over to the enemy, but have set my feet in a spacious place. Be merciful to me, O Lord, for I am in distress. My eyes grow weak with sorrow, my soul and my body with grief. My life is consumed by anguish and my years by groaning. My strength fails because of my affliction and my bones grow weak. Because of all my enemies, I am the utter contempt of my neighbors. I am a dread to my friends. Those who see me on the street flee from me. I am forgotten by them as though I were dead. I have become like broken pottery, for I hear the slander of many. There is terror on every side. They conspire against me and plot to take my life. But I trust in you, O Lord. I say you are my God. My times are in your hands. Deliver me from my enemies and from those who pursue me. Let your face shine on your servant. Save me in your unfailing love. Let me not be put to shame, O Lord, for I have cried out to you. But let the wicked be put to shame and lie silent in the grave. Let their lying lips be silenced, for with pride and contempt they speak arrogantly against the righteous. How great is your goodness, which you have stored up for those who fear you, which you bestow in the sight of men, on those who take refuge in you. In the shelter of your presence you hide them from the intrigues of men. In your dwelling you keep them safe from accusing tongues. Praise be to the Lord, for he showed his wonderful love to me when I was in a besieged city. In my alarm I said, I am cut off from your sight, yet you heard my cry for mercy when I called to you for help. Love the Lord, all his saints. The Lord preserves the faithful, but the proud he pays back in full. And this is my favorite. Be strong and take heart, all you who hope in the Lord. Worship team, guys, you can come back up too. The next day was the Sabbath. Every year on the Sabbath following Passover, there was a passage from Ezekiel read. It was Ezekiel 37. 1 through 14. I'm going to read it from over here to get out of Jordan's way. As soon as I turn to Ezekiel, there we go. So I imagine the disciples kind of in that funk we get in when we lose a loved one, just kind of going through the motions, and they're in the temple, and this was the reading. The hand of the Lord was upon me, and he brought me out by the Spirit of the Lord, and set me in the middle of a valley. It was full of bones. He led me back and forth among them, and I saw a great many bones on the floor of the valley, bones that were very dry. He asked me, Son of man, can these bones live? I said, O sovereign Lord, you alone know. Then he said to me, prophesy to these bones and say to them, dry bones, hear the word of the Lord. This is what the sovereign Lord says to these bones. I will make breath enter you, and you will come to life. I will attach tendons to you and make flesh come upon you and cover you with skin. I will put breath in you, and you will come to life. Then you will know that I am the Lord. So I prophesied as I was commanded, and as I was prophesying, there was a noise, a rattling sound, and the bones came together, bone to bone. I looked, and tendons and flesh appeared on them, and skin covered them, but there was no breath in them. Then he said to me, prophesy to the breath. Prophesy, son of man, and say to it, this is what the sovereign Lord says. Come from the four winds, O breath, and breathe into these slain, that they may live. So I prophesied as he commanded me, and breath entered them. They came to life and stood up on their feet, a vast army. Then he said to me, son of man, these bones are the whole house of Israel. They say, our bones are dried up, and our hope is gone. We are cut off. Therefore prophesy and say to them, this is what the sovereign Lord says. O my people, I am going to open your graves and bring you up from them. I will bring you back from the land of Israel. Then you, my people, will know that I am the Lord when I open your graves and bring you up from them. I will put my spirit in you, and you will live, and you will settle, and I will settle you in your own land. Then you will know that I, the Lord, have spoken, and I have done it, declares the Lord. So they go to their reading, they hear that. The next day they go to the tomb, and it's empty.